first, a lot of the food that we eat comes from key agricultural regions around the United States. The fruits, veggies, and nuts we count on year-round, many of them come from one part of California. And a lot of the meat that the U.S. depends on comes from here in the Midwest, with livestock fed by huge corn and soybean farms. But our next guest says those two regions aren't sustainable in the long run unless we make changes to preserve the water and soil that make it all possible. Tom Philpott is the food and agriculture correspondent for Mother Jones. His new book out today is Perilous Bounty, The Looming Collapse of American Farming and How We Can Prevent It. Tom, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
I want to visit each of these regions, first of all, and find out what's at stake here. Talk about, first of all, this basin, this valley in California, and how much we around the country depend on it for our produce.
Yeah, so there's this enormous valley in California called the Central Valley, and it goes, it stretches, down the middle of the state. It's like the spine of the state, starting, in Southern California and going all the way up to the Oregon border or near the Oregon border. And it's an amazing place to grow food, and a whole lot of the food that you see in the grocery store pretty much any time of the year comes from that valley, or there are a couple of other valleys in California that are also pretty big, but that's the dominant one. And so it's a place that we've sort of quietly come to rely on without thinking that much about it. And, in researching my book and in my work for Mother Jones, I've just been discovering that there is plenty to be concerned about this area.
We'll dig into that, but let's meet the other main character a little closer to home for us in Wisconsin, the Midwestern meat-producing region, and more importantly for your book in some ways, the place that produces all this soybeans and corn that goes to feed the livestock.
Right. So just as, basically we rely super, super heavily on California for our fruits and vegetables, we probably rely more on the Corn Belt, the states clustered around Iowa. Large parts of Wisconsin are included in it. We rely even more heavily on those places for another big pillar of our diets, and that's meat. Because as most people there know, the great bulk of the meat that we find in any supermarket, any fast food chain, almost any restaurant, is raised with corn and soybeans, largely grown on the fields of the Midwest.
Now let's check out the worries in each of these places. First of all, this California basin, we get so much of our, produce, our fruits, vegetables, nuts from there. You say there's a big worry about water in particular. What kind of stress is this agricultural system putting on the water in this region we count on?
Yeah, so, it's a really great place to grow food, and it actually has pretty amazing water resources, because the entire Central Valley is bordered on the east side by the Sierra Nevada mountain range. And the Sierra Nevada mountain range plays a key role in the weather of the entire West, because, what happens is you get these huge storms start off in the South Pacific, and they send literal rivers of water, atmospheric rivers of water to the West, and to the Western side of the United States. And what happens is in the summertime, they're largely diverted by high pressure systems north and south. So California doesn't really get very much water at all in the winter. And in the winter, they come straight into California and essentially hit the Sierra Nevada. And all this water falls as snow and creates this incredible resource, because that snow then melts in the spring, right when farmers are planting their crops. And you get this, there's been this incredible infrastructure of canals and aqueducts and dams that have been built up over the past century that divert this water onto farms. And so, in some ways, it's a great system and a great place to grow food. But the problem is that farms have gotten so big and so productive and so ravenous for water that their water needs have expanded dramatically beyond what the Sierra Nevada snowpack can satisfy. And they've taken to tapping water from the ground, and they're tapping it at such rates that the ground is literally sinking through large parts of this basin, causing all kinds of infrastructural problems. Bridges and roads and tunnels get snarled up by this subsidence, as it's called, when the land sinks. But the real problem for agriculture is that these aqueducts also get snarled up. And so you end up seeing water wasted, just sort of running off these aqueducts, not getting to farms. And so what do farms do in response? Well, they just, you know, revert to the well even more, suck up more water from the ground that causes more subsidence, that causes more snarl ups of the, you know, the Sierra Nevada infrastructure. And so you're in this loop of just sort of drawing the water down, this sort of race to the bottom of the aquifer.
And that's this water system, you write, is under stress in good years, if I'm reading you right. This is a place also that historically, we've seen in recent years, can have droughts. Talk about what happens when the system, already stretched to capacity in some ways, experiences a drought.
So what happens when you get a drought is that you get a veritable drilling frenzy. You get farmers who don't have wells because they're used to getting good water dropping new ones. You're getting farmers who already have wells and are already using them, dropping deeper ones. And so you just get this big sort of frenzy of well drilling. And one of the things that happens is that a lot of people who live in the Central Valley, most people who live in the Central Valley aren't very high income, especially in the rural parts of it. There's a lot of, farm workers working at poverty wages, not making really a living wage. And they, two things happen to their water. One, their water can literally be cut off. If you're, you know, in a rural area and you rely on a well, those wells routinely go dry during California droughts. The other thing that happens is that as the aquifer gets lower and lower, the naturally occurring elements in the water, the naturally occurring chemicals like arsenic concentrate, and also salts concentrate, and you get water that's undrinkable. And sometimes water that's too salty to grow crops in. But if you're a farm worker living in the area and you're making $18,000 a year, it's not very fun to have to pay thousands of dollars a year to buy drinking water, to buy bottled water for your family. And so that's one of the consequences of it.
We're talking to Tom Philpott about his new book out today. It's called Perilous Bounty, The Looming Collapse of American Farming and How We Can Prevent It. So it's water in this Central Valley in California that you're mainly worried about. Here in the Midwest, it's the soil. Talk about the threats you see there.
Yeah, so the problem that I see in the Midwest is that you've got this incredible resource of this loamy topsoil. You know, I should have said in California, it's one of the few Mediterranean climates in the world, and that's one of the reasons why it's such a great place to grow food. And the Midwest has this very rare and large stash of prairie-derived topsoils. It's one of the four or five places in the world that has a stash like that. Just, you know, feet and feet of loamy topsoil that grew up over millennia of interactions between prairie grasses and wetlands and bison and Native Americans sort of managing the process. And you go from that. And so in a system like that, the ground is covered year round. You've got these, you know, massive prairie grass plants plunging deep into the earth. You know, storms blow in the spring or late winter and doesn't cause soil erosion in any significant way. And when you go from there to narrowing down to two crops, corn and soybeans, that are both harvested in the fall and planted in the spring, don't really establish until, like, let's say May or June, you've got all these months of bare ground. And when you're increasingly dire and, you know, huge spring storms blow in, it just pounds that bare soil that's, you know, very often not covered. For the most part, cover crops and things like that aren't used very much. And what you see is soil erosion at levels that are just staggering.
And you see, tying both of these places together, California and the Midwest, a lot of political influence in the hands of the people making money off of it, which in many cases isn't the, you know, the actual farmer. It's the companies that sell them their supplies and that that move along their produce. Talk about the political side of this.
Yeah, so I have a big chapter in there in the book, just sort of laying out how the real beneficiaries of the system aren't the farmers really so much, because when you're growing commodities like corn and soybeans, you're sort of living under hyper competition. You're competing with your neighbors who are growing the same crop. You're competing with farmers in Brazil, where they're plowing up the savanna at, you know, staggering rates to put in what, corn and soybeans. And oftentimes the soybeans are higher quality in terms of protein and things like that than U.S. soybeans. You've also got, you're competing against farmers in Ukraine that are doing the same thing with one of these other, you know, rare stores of topsoil, prairie-derived topsoils. Same with Argentina. They have got this great Pampas region that's similar to the Midwest. They're very rapidly putting in corn and soybeans. So you've got this hyper-global competition, but really there's this interlocking set of companies that that basically dominate this trade globally. So you've got your seed / pesticide companies that sell the sort of, you know, technology protected, patent protected seeds that farmers pay a technology fee on. They're often paired with their own pesticides. Three or four companies, basically in the U.S., two companies dominate the trade in corn and soybean seeds. You've got, a small handful of meat companies that have been in the headlines recently for horrible conditions in their meatpacking plants. But they're the ones that buy all these corn and soybeans and turn them into meat. They're a very tightly consolidated group of companies. The tractor companies, there's just two of them really that dominate the trade in tractors and combines. Fertilizer is also very consolidated. Grain trading is basically Cargill and Bunge and Archer Daniels Midland. And so what you get is very little competition among these suppliers and hyper competition by the farmers. And so these, the suppliers and buyers, and these companies capture the profits from this trade. And being sort of smart, companies, they invest a portion of that profit in lobbying in Washington, in campaign finance. And, sort of the farm bill and other farm policies basically enshrine this corn and soybean duopoly, and they're the ones benefiting from it. And they will fight, really hard in Washington to maintain that system. That, I should say, why do farmers keep planting if they're not getting profits from it? Well, the answer is these government programs, crop subsidies, sort of keep them afloat. And so we, the public, are keeping farmers afloat while these companies make off with all the profits.
Tom Philpott is with us, author of the new book, Perilous Bounty, The Looming Collapse of American Farming and How We Can Prevent It. You can join in with your thoughts, questions, maybe experiences at 800-642-1234. As a consumer, do you seek out local produce, dairy products, meats? Are you worried about a big, large-scale agriculture in this country? If you work in agriculture yourself, what do things look like from your point of view and what you hear the guest saying? Do you do things, if you farm at any scale, to try to protect the soil, the quality of your soil, the erosion of your soil? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Tom Philpott about his new book out today. It's called Perilous Bounty, The Looming Collapse of American Farming and How We Can Prevent It. Tom profiles farmers and activists who are trying to save American farming in the face of risks to the soil and water that make it all possible. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions or thoughts about how we produce and distribute our food in the United States? Do you try to buy local when you can? Do you work in agriculture yourself at any part of the process? What do you think about our guest has to say about his concerns, especially here in the Midwest, about preserving our soil? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Tom, we've laid out the outlines of the problem. You go into a lot more detail in the book, of course, but I want to spend a little time on what you see in terms of solutions. And you write that it's more than just, consumer-driven, consumers trying to solve the problem by their choices.
Yeah, I think that's right, because I think in this country we have had a pretty amazing movement over the past 20 years, let's say, of people asking questions about where their food comes from, seeking out local farmers. We've seen a boom in farmers markets that has leveled off, but at a level that would not have been imaginable 20 years ago. We've seen, CSAs, community supported agriculture programs on a similar trajectory. We've seen big food companies, supermarket companies buying local food or trying to buy local food, buying organic. But, it we've gotten to this great place, and I have seen a leveling off in things like farmers markets, and yet all of the problems that I write about in the book have intensified over the same period. California's in worse, the Central Valley's in worse shape, the Midwest is in worse shape, and climate change is actually accelerating both the problems that we just talked about, bigger storms, bigger droughts, et cetera, because of climate change. And so what I think that we have to do now is figure out how, as a society, we can wrest control of farm policy, you know, both in state houses, places like Sacramento in California, and, you know, state houses in the Midwest, and also in DC, how we can wrest it away from these vested interests that are benefiting from the situation. And, you know, like I said, they invest a lot of their money in it. And I guess that the things that I have seen that have given me most hope are things like the Green New Deal proposal that was floated a couple of years ago by Senator Markey and Representative Ocasio-Cortez out of New York. And, you know, it was sort of a vague policy proposal with some goals. And the idea was that, you know, social movements, people involved in climate activism, people involved in food activism would come together and come up with the policies necessary to meet these goals. And I think, you know, the sort of Green New Deal idea lost a lot of momentum, I think, when the Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren campaigns ended up not being successful. They were proponents of it, they were pushing it, and they lost to a candidate, Joe Biden, who's not that into it. But, you know, I am getting some a strange bit of hope from this awful pandemic situation that we're in. There's nothing good about it. It's killing people. It's creating a giant economic crisis. But I do think that heading out of this crisis, we're going to need a big jobs program and a big change in the economy to sort of get people working again. And I think that the Green New Deal is sort of one of these ideas that are lying around. I think it was Milton Friedman who said, in a crisis, you look to the ideas that are lying around. And, you know, here's this idea lying around for, if you look at Bernie Sanders' proposal, there's a lot of detail in there about, you know, diversifying agriculture in the Midwest, you know, paying farmers to store carbon in soil. And in California, you know, basically California, I didn't really mention the California crisis that much, but there was a lot of, you know, sort of money and proposals in there for building out local and regional fruit and vegetable farming that could just take pressure off of California. So as California adjusts to its new water reality, which it has to do, we're not left wanting fruits and vegetables because we'll have more local fruits and vegetables produced. And I think that, you know, since we know that we're in an economic crisis and we know we need a big economic plan to move out of it, I think something like the Green New Deal could be something that people rally around as our society figures out how to get out of this economic crisis.
Absent a nationwide effort like that, we've on this show talked to farmers in the state trying to protect their watersheds in part by using cover crops or other techniques. Do you see maybe small and mid-sized agriculture taking the lead and at least piloting some things that could help solve some of these problems?
Oh, yeah. I have a lot. I have some of those anecdotes in the book, and that is exactly what's happening. You've got farmers who are looking really hard for a different way and experimenting with new models that work at least as well as a big commodity system economically for them. But that also clean up water. And I think that, you know, you guys in Wisconsin have a lot of problems with watersheds getting polluted by large dairy CAFOs. And you've got a problem of low dairy prices pushing, smaller mid-sized dairy farmers out of business and, giving more power to the large operators. And I think we're going to see a lot of pushback on a local level to some of these problems. One of the things I try to make clear in the book is that industrial agriculture's sort of costs are felt most keenly and most immediately by the people in the areas where it happens. And I think that we already see social movements in places like the Central Valley in California, in places like Iowa, that are pushing back really hard against this these catastrophes. And that too gives me a lot of hope.
just in our last couple of minutes, if we stick with our status quo, plus climate change, of course, spend a couple of minutes telling us what's at stake, what could be lost if we stay on this course.
I mean, if we stay on the course, we're going to see harsher and harsher storms thundering through the Midwest in the spring and summer. We're going to see more and more soil going on the move. We're going to get to a point where just adding more fertilizer doesn't boost yields up, and there's no seeds that are going to bail us out of it. There's no, like, you know, drought tolerant GMO seed that is going to deal with, you know, less and less water, or a seed that will help a corn plant yield high with poor soil. I mean, it's way too complicated. It just doesn't exist. And we're going to see, you know, things like the bounty in the produce aisle that we're used to, any time of year, just all of this incredible stuff for not very much money, relatively speaking. We'll see a change in that. That is inevitable. And the sort of way that Americans for a couple of generations, if you have a decent amount of money, you don't have to think about that much about your food system. That's going to change. We're going to be in a situation where if we don't get ahead of this, we are going to have crises imposed on us. And I think the COVID-19 situation is showing us that we need to work on our crisis response as a society. We need to figure out better ways to deal with crisis. Because if we don't change course with our food system, we are going to see many crises coming down the pike.
Tom, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. Great conversation.
Tom Philpott is the food and agriculture correspondent for Mother Jones. We've been talking about his new book out today. It's called Perilous Bounty, The Looming Collapse of American Farming and How We Can Prevent It.